works on that.
Going to drug and alcohol services. You know, we hear stories about kids
being with their either drug or alcohol parents or other family members, and actually the impact that has. So that's a really important service that we provide for children. Any questions on public health yet?
Sorry, I just wanted to ask, to stop me scrolling 100 notes or trying to take photos.
Yes.
Are these slides able to be shared with
you?
So I suppose just a question, obviously, I don't see special education on needs and disabilities mentioned anywhere on those slides, and I think probably, like many of us in the room, obviously COVID being a massive public health case in point, certainly there was no provision for my autistic ADHD, OCD, sensory challenge son to get COVID vaccinations, and it was a complete and utter nightmare. The GP didn't have provision, the main massive huge vaccination centres didn't have provision, and until very, very late on, as an afterthought, there were lots of like catch-up sessions where kids would send in hospitals. Which you didn't really want to go to either.
So
that's an example. But in general, where's the send overlay to that?
And I think that's a good point. So I was actually working in a completely different area at that time, and I know the difficulties that parents were facing with the same level.
The classic, in fact, was that my son was actually in a specialist school, and they were still there at that point. They had been sent home, and vaccination nurses came in to do a certain age group within the school, but refused to do the other kids in the school because they were too old.
So what I'd say, probably not so much within the public health team. So this is a bit of a show and tell around what all the services are predominantly all of them. So I'd say probably less so, although I think there will be, more for children in need. There'd be the close links in with the drug and alcohol teams and children's services as part of child protection, if you like. But I think
as a student, child protection, though, because obviously a lot of young adults with ADHD in particular, they're in mental health crisis, reach for alcohol or drugs. If there's no specific sense thread within those services, it shouldn't just be a child in need, child protection issue. It should be a sense.
We'll come on to that when we go to mental health.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is actually a specific children's element of the drug and alcohol team as well. So they do run particular clinics for that younger cohort as well.
Yeah, and I think the challenge that I would put through to the team is actually how do they make all of the services accessible? What are the kind of special provisions? So I know we're looking at the next slide and we'll come and talk about that, but even with the child weight management, actually where are the forums for that? How are they engaging with that as well? Sexual health services, what is our approach? How easy is it for children with learning disabilities, etc., to actually source that information and access those services, because we're talking about up to 18 as well. So I think the challenge for all of us as commissioners is to think about accessibility, and it continues to be so. Just want to make that.
I think specifics as well, we know that ARFID, eating disorders within the same community, where's the service for that? Where's the understanding of that? Hypermobility, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, POTS, all of
even
those things.
OCD as well, and how that fits into waste management services, and how those conversations with commissioning happen, knowledge around those is seriously lacking.
There's a very, very high link between autism and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and yet walking into a GP, it's like you've literally landed on another planet. What is that? Who do we even refer to?
Even pals
don't know what.
literally you're scouring the internet on NHS policies trying to work out what on earth the referral route might look like. And that's not right.
We need to find a friend, a send friend of GP. We went with, up until fairly recently, our other GP came because we were out of catchment and they brought in this new thing where you had to be in catchment. So we got this new thing, but I had to go around and read about different surgeries because I've got three kids with Fragile X syndrome, mm-hmm. and they're young people now, mm-hmm. but you know they have their own issues and communicating with a doctor or whatever, and I had to saying, look, you know, they will need some support in there. And because the young people, you know, a lot of the time they're like, oh, we've got to speak to you now. So yeah. I have to write a letter to say, you know, but you then you have to explain about Fragile X syndrome because they don't, you know, they don't know about it or whatever. And you know, you don't see the same GP all the time. So I mean that was a concern for me, I don't know about but to find, you know, send friendly.
And I think it's also practices
and
things. There's also connected issues to that, which are things like, okay, one of the issues that my son really struggles with going into a lot of these like clinical environments is anxiety.
Yeah.
Waiting on, we're never going to get there on time, and then all in the morning, you've got no choice about the appointment time. So, you're like, trying to get them out the door, knowing full well that if you've got any appointment before midday, that's almost going to be like mission impossible. But you know, we'll try and get in there. And you know, we've missed the appointment. Well, there's no one to talk to, there's no one to get that appointment set up again.
That should come under the Oliver McGowan, though. That would come under Oliver McGowan, so they should all be aware in hospitals and doctors under that.
But they're not, so I'm just saying, you know, it's not just about getting the diagnosis or getting that first appointment, it's then actually your treatment and the way that that whole service is delivered.
Maybe
and
it's
actually,
seen two doctors or something. Because my son, especially he's the youngest, to get to know a certain professional. So, and he gets filled up around, yes, trust.
And can I just ask, do you have kind of links into primary care to talk about these as a collective?
Yep.
Okay, so we can take them back in the first instance with our primary care.
It's mandatory training, though, Robin McGowan, so it should be that they're already aware of it.
Well, I don't think it's just the training. I think it's about the whole environment as well. That's what I'm hearing. So it's multifaceted.
Yeah, and I think there was some very interesting work that they did at Albany Hospital, and they have done family journeys through the entirety of their journey at the unit. So it's not just about the service that you're accessing, but actually it's about the environment and what you have to go through on the process to get into your appointment. So there was one particular child's journey who they had to go past the canteen, which or someone with sensory issues around smells of food, real problem. But actually, as a result of that work, they started to adapt how they're setting up their services and what support is put in place how it sounds like young person. So there's starting to be things happening elsewhere that I'm sure will inform our work moving forward. What we hear you, it's about those reasonable adjustments in healthcare settings and commission service settings that will allow it to be easier for your children.
We'll take that back quite strongly. Carolyn, did you want to come in and then
I was just going to say a couple of things really. One of them is that there is now work being done to get a reasonable adjustment flag for all GP and health records, which would then be translated to the Employer Health Record, which said, you know, actually this is, I need a reasonable adjustment and then there's reasonable adjustments for it, which isn't, you know, it's not perfect, but it's something more than probably what we've got at the moment. And the other bit of work that I've been involved in and I've got a meeting later on about is a kind of recognition that not all of our health providers have had training in how to communicate with somebody who has additional needs, and that might be that they've got neurodiversity, it might be that they've got an hearing impairment. So we're looking at whether we can pull together a package of kind of bite-sized training that would be available to GPs, to be available to the dietitian. alliances to whoever it is that you might come across that would enable them to have their business.
Opticians as well, when they ask them to look into the machine and they start, you know, they're very dull and they're all like new trained, and he's kind of freaking out, and I'm like, they're like, he really needs it done, and I'm like, he doesn't like the lights.
It's already there. It just needs to be implemented.
The other one that is
mandatory, but they're still not implemented.
It's not implemented yet, so I agree. And actually,
Tell you now that all of them are always trained in it, because I've come across that where they nearly killed my daughter at the John Radcliffe because they weren't trained in it and they didn't know. But it just needs to be reinforced.
Yeah. And it's those small steps we are trying to make to try and reinforce it out there. But, you know, going back to the school situation, we can advise, we can train, but we can't enforce. You know.
Sorry, Miss Lady, I think you wanted to...
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's a massive grey area if you've got learning difficulties and not disabilities. And... you're in like no man's land. That needs to be sort of addressed somehow as well. I don't know how.
And what would you suggest?
Well,
what would you like to say?
I would change it from learning disabilities to learning difficulties to broaden the thing, because actually some children will look like they've got a learning disability through lack of education because of not being supported, but actually they've got a learning difficulty and needed it readjusted. And I know we've got the learning disability register, but there isn't the learning difficulties register.
That is the subject and the definition of learning disability, whereas learning difficulty, which is not a constant, is a subject being discussed by NHS England. I know because colleagues in the area and region have been pulled into that. That is a big debate actually about what is the definition of disability.
Things like the LG review on your children reach 14. Two children, two separate schools, admitted in both special needs schools. They're telling me at 14 onwards are allowed an LG review for GP. Speak to your teacher, it's like you want to put your child on months. You know,
it's the LG health check, isn't it, at
14? Yeah. And I have to literally show it in the Google on my phone to prove that surgery is done as one that provides
And they've got targets to actually hit the LD.
But when you speak to professionals, you know what they can be like. It's almost like we don't do that stuff.
And is your GP in Bucks?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to have to cut a lot of the physics with the information on my phone from the government saying...
Well, you shouldn't have to do that.
No, we shouldn't have to, but we did.
Yeah.
Again, it's something you could have trained into GPs, but you're only doing.
Yeah, but then also ties into the fact that I've got special needs children, I had to cut the mission to speak on their behalf from the age of about 12. Yeah. That is ridiculous.
That's because it comes up with get excellent.
Yeah, I know, but it's just ridiculous. They can't talk to themselves.
When you go to the GP for that learning disabilities check, the questions on that, have you seen that?
No, I haven't recently, no.
Can you wash yourself? My son's autistic, because he can. No, he does not. I have to tell him to go into the bathroom.
So
can he dress himself? Yeah. Appropriately? No. Does he change his clothes? No. That's the thing I do. Now, this form is then filled out. The most ridiculous questions I've ever seen.
This is within the health check.
This is the health check for when you're 14. You go in there. Can he wash himself? Can he toilet himself? Yeah, of course he can. Does he clean himself? Absolutely not. Do I then have to tell him to go and have a shower? Yeah, so is he doing that himself, or am I doing that?
So if you talk about that, because when you go to the people diagnosing learning disabilities, so if you go and say my child's got learning disability, unless it's actually got on the record of being a learning disability, they'll ask you a series of questions.
So it's this way.
You
go to the shimmy chair, and they ask you, do you have autism? We do the temperature check, and they ask him if he can shower. So he in his edges, he can. And he wants to get the questions right because he's 16-year-old. And he wants to impress me, and I'm sat there saying, absolutely not, because patient's clean, I have to send it back in the shower and wash his hair.
That is misinformation.
Yeah, and then
I think what we need, because I can't answer the primary care questions, but I think it's really important that we feed that back and see how do we
take it. I think Belinda's got a message about primary care and GPs. I think that it's an area where it would be really nice to have more engagement. I know that it's something that Health Watch are looking at, and they wanted this year, we did PFA transitions last year with them, they wanted a new subject for this one. I wonder what it's going to be, and I think obviously GPs, particularly
on
sensories.
No,
the health watch, something they can define, and I think that's probably...
I think the primary care bit is something...
There's a lot of work done on primary care.
I think so, I can hear that. This lady, and then I'll need to move on.
Sorry, it's not a question. Something,
yes.
Missed it, and I don't know if it's helpful to parents or not, but I do a lot of voluntary work with Oxford Health.
Okay.
Within the adult and older adult mental health teams, and I sit on the board ICB on a lot of work. There is already such thing as a digital red flag for health systems for neurodivergent people within Oxford Health. You can ask for it to be done to include these records. And we've also developed a Bob ICB neurodivergent passport, which is really thorough, really in-depth, completely different to anything you're going to get from the National Autistic Society or anything. I've given it to the learning disability and autism nurses at all the hospitals that you go to. I've given it to our GPs, I've given it to our dentists, I've given it to schools.
Thank you for doing that.
I can share the link.
Yeah. Do you have it, Andrew?
Maybe, or someone,
it should be, and if it's not, I apologise, and it will be by the end of the week, the local offer. I'll make sure it goes on the local offer.
I did give one to Hillary at the last Send Employment Forum.
Yes, so we've done some interesting this afternoon. We've built some of that into the passport. So it came from a bit of Bob work.
It's from our Thinking Neurodivergent Forum that was set up for
first
users.
What's the name of the passport?
It's called Neurodivergent
Passport. Is that my little passport for them? Because
it's an A4 double-sided piece of paper.
Yeah.
It's not just tick boxes, there's plenty of space for you to write about specific needs.
Some of you will know me, some of you haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, but just to give you an overview of my team. So we're known as the All Age Prevention Team. The vast majority of our work revolves around health provision for children, both with and without. So as you can see up there, the specialist public health nursing services, so I've already heard at least one person mention health visitors. So this is our health visitors, our family nurse partnership, and our school nursing services in the local area. Just to point out, not special school nursing, because that's a different profession. I also cover off the integrated therapist contract. Our community PED service is one that my team contract manages, as well as the health assessments for children looked after, the community nursing for children with LD, fact books, quite recently added to the team's portfolio, and the bit of good news that I'm bringing here is we are just in the process of signing a contract with AES to bring the parent portal to Bucks, which is
AES?
Autism Early Support. So they're our local autism charity, one of our local autism charities. They were involved in the development of the pre-diagnostic support offer that CAMHS have been offering. They're usually focused on early age, but actually they do support.
Sorry, what's that cancer focusing on?
Sorry?
What's the cancer focusing on?
So a couple of years ago we developed the pre-diagnostic support offer that CAMHS currently offer for those on the waiting list.
But they refuse to assess much of them?
as an extension, what AES have done and what we've been working with them to do is to be able to offer out their support portal. So that's information, advice and guidance for any parent who has a child who they think may be neurodivergent. So it's not even that you're waiting for diagnosis, we're making it openly available. And alongside that, they're offering a forum, an online networking site, so that actually parents can self-support or get in touch with members of the AES team for any advice or guidance on more specific issues.
Because in Berkshire, I think it's called Parenting Special Needs or something like that.
Yes.
There's a much more comprehensive service than that in place.
ADHD.
No, it's everything. It's for autism and ADHD. So there are basically pre and post diagnostic sessions that you can.
That's what this.
Okay, so this is in person.
They do some face to face. Some online.
AES is a charity. It originates in Edinburgh's Puzzle Centre, which is a preschool in Middleclay.
Well, that worries me. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's where it initiated.
So, does this charity promote applied behavioural analysis and positive behavioural support? Because the Puzzle Centre certainly does.
It does not. I know because I talked to. That's one of the questions I asked the lady who's responsible for running the AES side of that particular question, and they don't. I've had them right. The AES portal is self. It reevaluates the parents' input into it and rechanges it because the parents are engaging with it. So it's driven by the parents who are engaging with it. So this is, I think, the word I'm trying to do, the language comes up.
Well, it needs to be neuroaffirmative.
That's a phrase that the people who use it change it and therefore improve it, and that's the
so
way to
all, so just to give you some assurance, all the way through the development of the pre-diagnostic and the way that AES generally work. Mm-hmm. So quarterly we get reports from them in terms of what parent feedback they've had, and some of that's narrative, some of it's like from questionnaires that you fill out when you've completed a training course. But actually they're there already with all of the comments and saying, well, actually we've implemented some of this stuff already. So one really good example was in the early days of that pre-diagnostic support, there were a number of different questions about PDA. From parents, and so they went, they found the information that they needed, gathered it together, and actually then included that as a specific option within the training. So it's that type of responsive approach.
How does that sit alongside saying what early help might provide?
So this will be promoted across all kind of settings, if you like. So the schools will be involved in promotion and referral. There will be health services, our family hubs will be aware of it, and there will be champions within each of those services, so that actually, it doesn't matter where you go, if a parent mentions that they think their child might have autism, that actually, that will be part of the offer.
Most of us probably in the room have been put on a parenting course.
Yes. 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 Actually, I would like to ask as well, because that narrative is still happening, so while seeking support from CAMHS, I was referred to the school nursing team, and was looking to contact the school nursing team. Yeah. They won't work with me unless I've been on a parenting course. Yeah. Now, I've been on parenting courses for the last 5 or 6 years. I can assure you my children are neurodivergent, and we're parenting in a neurodivergent affirming way. I'm not perfect, but we're past the point.
I'd really like to get a bit more detail on that experience so that I can take it back to the service,
triple,
because that absolutely
triple P and all that nonsense
from CAMHS or from the nursing team.
From the nursing team.
But how can a nursing team help with mental health that's created by a school environment that surely should be, you know, the whole system is still passing one off against the other and still requesting parents on parenting courses. So you're left in a situation like me where you're going to private counselling, private doctor surgeries, private paediatricians, because the...
Can we touch base and I'll get more detail on that? That's fabulous, thank you.
Is this something we have to go through CAMHS first, or can we do another referral?
No, we're making.
I spoke to someone yesterday because my son has suspected ASD and ARFRED, and I've been called from pillar to post, and apparently I've got to go through the school nursing team. But when I've done a referral, this is nothing about ARFRED on
As part of the AS offer, there is no requirement for you to be on a waiting list for a neuroassessment.
He's on a pathway for his diagnosis.
Yeah.
But in between the 3-year waiting list, I'm like, that's really good, but I need help now.
Yeah, that's what it's there for.
Yeah.
It's because we heard what parents were saying about actually it's fine getting something offered to me while I'm waiting on a waiting list. But actually what we need is something that's at the point that we're starting to notice that there's something.
Patients, though, these people have that are answering questions in these forums, like, who are they, basically?
If you go on their website, they do explain about their team.
Yeah, the team has made presentations to the ND pathway parent dialogue group on a number of occasions in the past, but I'm sure that the ladies responsible will happily provide a statement that we can share. On essence of their and how they work just to, in sense of using the their ambition is to make sure that it's driven by those who understand. If you understand the best way of putting it, so they don't work on their own knowledge; they seek out knowledge from people who are better qualified. That's the phrase that Sarah uses all the time: better qualified than I am.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll just say my daughter is
old;
she's 15. She had a diagnosis of global delay. X amount of years ago. She's only had one SRP when she's 3 years old. We've been refused constantly, more reviews. At the LD review, the HD was mentioned, Karen said no. So will these people be able to help?
We recognise that there's a current issue with the way that learning disability is diagnosed in Bucks. We're aware of it and we work with partners to try to resolve that.
Because the thing I get told, she's in a special needs school, what do you need to know? Because she's 15, we're now looking at post-16 and onwards. We're not just talking the next 2-3 years of sixth form.
Yeah, we realise that there is a significant impact on families through that diagnostic process not working.
Because they don't want to do it, they're, oh, she's in the right place. Well, yeah, she is coming out. But she's also got the noise, she's coming out, she's picking herself. Not washing and stuff that she can do.
Yeah.
So there's more to look at, but you just get told to ignore it. It's just ridiculous.
Are you onto the community paediatric team? Does that interest?
She's not, that's the issue.
Not.
Okay. My son is, but she isn't because she was like, well, when she was 3 years old, we have 4 times teaching.
We can have a conversation offline.
Yeah, because the school, even though especially in school, they still refuse to help with the assessment. Because they say, they agree with Kat, Kat didn't get very far. A letter from the OD actually stated of LSD. I wasn't saying that all I wanted a starting point of an assessment, whether that's an ed psych or something, then move on from there. Between the school and accounting, so she doesn't need an ed psych because, again, she's in the right placement.
Again,
I get told, go and pay for it yourself.
Can I catch you after and just get a bit more detail? So you
said about learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. Buckinghamshire Children's Services like to diagnose children with learning disabilities without
actually a diagnosis.
Yeah, my son's, I pay for private ed sites. He hasn't got a learning disability, but social care cannot comprehend that he hasn't got a learning disability because it's through lack of education from Barks, but because we don't have learning difficulties books, we have to take a learning disability, which is not.
Okay.
So why is he still being labelled as a learning disability when he's not got it? Because you shouldn't just be labelling children with learning disabilities. And I've been arguing this till I'm blue in the face. So then I'm like, well, I think you might have because you're not comprehending it. Can I just go around labelling everybody?
But I think I hear you in terms of that difference because I know that actually learning disability is a diagnosed condition, whereas a learning difficulty is at an earlier stage. In terms of,
but why is social care thinking that they can label children?
I think that's a training issue that we, by all means, can feed back in terms.
I put in complaints about it. It's at second stage.
Okay.
Because you're not listening to anywhere.
I'm just wondering, Andrew, do we know when this feedback from relations England around this, or is it in early stages around the whole kind of debate around learners?
I'll have to find out. I can speak to you. There's so many things to cross my mind.
Yeah.
With social care, the other issue with learning with disability is that I don't remember, if I get quoted back on this, the trouble is so many things said to me over so many years, but I'm sure there's another, it's a bit like the dynamics service, where you have to still have a diagnosis of autism in order to get on it, even though we don't have diagnosis-led services anymore, because it's somewhere in some national piece of legislation, no one's changed. I think the same issue applies to statutory funding, and I think you might find that there's, if I remember rightly, the learning disability gets labelled because it unplugs certain statutory funding. Without it, you can't have certain bits of statutory funding.
Yeah, because respite units, you cannot access the respite
units. That's
what
I'm saying.
So then it's not meeting the correct need.
What I'm trying to say to you is that there are some circumstances when practitioners do things because they know otherwise they can't get you the money. Yeah. The law won't let them. And it doesn't mean that they agree with it, yeah. It's just what they have to do.
But I would rather not have it and myself get labelled.
Well, then that's a reason for you to argue it. I'm just saying that generally, I do know that on occasions there are these things hidden away in bits of legislation. It's a bit like why transport wasn't extended to 18 when they changed the statutory school age. Who knows? Some of the Department of Education failed to move their pen on the paper, did they? But, you know, it's one of those bits, and I think there are sometimes these things that happen.
Yeah, because you cannot
trying to do the right thing.
So, respite units, you have to have a learning disability to be able to access them. You've got a learning difficulty.
I'm Ollie Sutton-Sheen. I am the Specialist Commission Manager for the Your Age Disability Team. My work is generally focused on two kinds of areas. Number one is kind of the more forward-thinking work, so it's around looking at strategy, how can we meet future needs, how can we make sure that the services that we have are fit for the individuals who need that care and support, and that we're delivering them at the right time. So that's the first slide that I've got here, really, in terms of how what areas of priority we're looking at to deliver that kind of work. So up here you'll see we've got the autism strategy. As Andrew has mentioned, something which has been needed within the county for a long, long time, way, way overdue. And there is now, I'm really happy to say, national legislation which says that each individual place, so in terms of county rather than system-wide, must have a strategy which is suitable for the needs of that individual place. So for the last few years, we've been working on developing a co-produced strategy, and I genuinely do mean that, because actually, what you know, we often mention these words around co-production, we had that earlier. What does that mean? It's not just us telling you what we think and then asking you to comment. So this has been developed from the starting point of us not having preconceptions and saying, tell us from the starting point, and then we'll start to develop that piece of work. So if we looked at, I suppose, demographic information, it would say that for a population the size of Bucks, we've got around 5,000 individuals who are autistic or neurodiverse. The feedback that we've received so far, 500 people, residents from within the county, who have fed into that process. So genuinely hope that what you've experienced is a co-production approach, and we will continue using that approach in terms of the next steps for this strategy, which is looking at an action plan where all of that feedback, all of that information you've told us about what's important to you, what's important to your loved ones about services, and about access and support and information goes into an action plan that we can kind of make real with our partners. So,
positive for once.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I was part of the group of stakeholders who were involved in co-producing the autism strategy, and it absolutely was from the very ground up properly, truly co-produced.
Which it hadn't been.
I'm really, really used to it.
And I share that, that everywhere, particularly in presenting who don't follow their own co-production charter, and I use you guys as an example of good practice.
I mean, that was lovely to hear, and I really appreciate that. But as much as we know that that wasn't a good example of practice, there's, you know, we need to apply that same approach elsewhere.
Absolutely.
There's much more to do. But thank you ever so much for feeding that in, because the team who work on it are incredibly passionate about it, and they want it to be successful, and they want it to be developed in the right way. So I'll pass that back to them. I'm sure they'll be absolutely thrilled with that feedback. But we want to use that same approach as well for the action plan. So as I say, making it real. Now that we've heard your feedback, now that we know what's the most important in terms of priorities and developments, this part of the work is around grabbing together all of those partners in Buckinghamshire who can physically make those changes and adaptations so that we can move this forward. So a lot of the work doesn't actually sit within our portfolio. It sits with health partners. A really good example we shared with the room, primary health GP practices. You know, so we've got the example of the Oliver McGowan training. It's statutory, it's mandatory training. Everyone should be participating within that piece of training. How can we make sure through the action plan and steering route, which is kind of being held to account at the highest levels of the council, so shared by councillors, reporting directly into the leadership of the council, so that it has that level of visibility. How can we make sure that our statutory partners are fulfilling those obligations to you?
And I think a massive issue on that, which obviously I'm just like, you know, is really large all over your slide, which all age. And I think there's a lot of people in this room that would agree that, you know, Buckinghamshire have, it's almost like a miracle county where when you reach the age of 18, or you're not anymore, all your needs miraculously disappear. And you are left with nothing. And obviously, if they get away with leaving you with nothing at 16, they'll try that on as well. But at 18, you know, you are cut loose without a parachute. So, all age really does need to be all age. Preparation for adulthood, or that, you know, it shouldn't come as a sort of surprise that, that people get older. And yet, we haven't got time to do a transition to adult services. We haven't got it wasn't a surprise, you know.
That's absolutely correct. Youngsters turning into adults, as you say, there is no secret that that happens. But
can I just say as well, sorry to interrupt, but even when it goes up to 25, we're saying our kids aren't 25 up here. So really, it shouldn't be up to 25. It should just carry on. Regardless, because they're still in need. I was told when my daughter got, she's now 26 out of the system, she hasn't got autism anymore. Can I?
I look forward to my reaching that.
Yeah.
I've no idea why you were told that. Obviously, that's categorically wrong, but it's a really key point you've raised around all age being part of this strategy as well. One of the huge things that everyone's been telling us is exactly what you just reflected back to us now. The planning and the transition between children's services and adult services.
Can I just say transitions team are very good. They're a lot more helpful.
And I don't mean transitions team themselves, but in terms of processes, of how those delegations of responsibilities are, and I hate to use these terms because it makes it sound really transactional, but they're transferred, how they move from one area to the other. What we need you to experience is that seamlessly and smooth, rather than it being, you've hit a hard deadline, there is a reason for us to do a thing, that is a piece of work, and then that block of move gets kind of moved down the line. So the work plan is about hearing all of that feedback, you know, that valid critique, and making sure that we can start to move forward in a different space, right? So rather than, unless you've got this label, you can't receive the service. You know, one of the real examples that I'm really happy that Marie brought up was around AES, because it came directly from the fact that unless you were in that pathway, unless you were either waiting for a diagnosis or you'd already receive the diagnosis, only then were you receiving access to the support. But as we've heard in the room, if you know that that process is a three-year process, what are you to do in the meantime?
Yeah.
You know, you either sit on your hands, or I know that that's not the case of what you've done. We've got parents who are incredibly engaged and have gone out and found the information themselves.
But no choice.
Should they have to do that, can we help? Can we facilitate that in a better way? So that's what we're trying to deliver within
the other thing, though, is that you just mentioned the service word, which just gets my hackles up. Because, you know, I know that you guys think in services, but we don't. We think in terms of, you know, what our child needs. And, you know, unfortunately, very often, that doesn't neatly fit to a service. And he doesn't want a personal assistant, because actually...
That's all we can offer you.
But that's all we can offer you. And if you don't do that, we are basically going to send you a letter in a week's time saying, discharging you, because, like, you're not neatly fitting the services we can deliver, so therefore, you don't need them.
Oh, CAMHS do that,
yeah. And it's widespread. So, you know, yes.
And one department doesn't talk to the other. Yeah. We've had a response from the ICE Centre team saying, no, I don't think this will be funded under any OTAS package, even though it's in Section F, which means legally their responsibility. We believe that funding should come from social care. Did they communicate with social care?
No.
We assume that that communication is going on, but no one's doing anything.
And there's legislation which says that they need to coordinate it. It's their responsibility, it's their duty to do so, and yet it's left to us to coordinate. And not only that, if we haven't contacted the service, we're then blamed. Well, that hasn't happened because you didn't contact the social services. It's like, hold on a minute, where's that my responsibility?
And I think, if I'm completely honest about the strategy, probably the biggest area of development of it, and this is something that we've had to try to explain within our own structures and within the council itself, is that this isn't a strategy that's going to produce a new thing. It's not about us saying, here is, I'm going to use the word, but here's a service, here is a thing. The benefit of it is actually taking those disparate partners who, in theory, should be talking to each other, who should be working together, and should understand what each other can offer and can do, but actually putting them in one place. Putting them in one place so that we can clearly say to those people, this bit hasn't worked. You haven't told you about what this step is, and making them talk to each other so that it's a more fluid kind of approach, rather than us saying, you're either in this pathway or you're in this pathway, or at what point do you jump out of this pathway into the other? So that's kind of, I'm hoping what's coming across is that the auditing strategy is about facilitation, really, and I'm hoping that what we can do when we start bringing in the team around how that's going to drive the improvement forward, it's going to be absolutely critical that FACT partners and parent partners are around the table as well, so we continue to have that co-production approach. What we don't end up doing is cancelling the approach again, and you know, reverting to that type of us area doing this.
Just ask, how do you take that strategy and filter it down to the little people? Not the little people, because that's not what I really mean, but do you know what I mean? Like, if you take a school, for example, you can speak to a head teacher and a Senko, and you can feel really reassured as a parent that they kind of understand it, but then that information about your child, the EHCP or whatever, doesn't filter down to the teachers on the ground, and that, as parents, is what we experience within the council. Like, we speak to people like you, or Maria, we feel really reassured that actually, you know, you get it and you're working to make it happen, but it doesn't filter down to the on-the-ground people that we have those everyday interactions with, the echoes, the CAMHS partners, the, you know, it just never filters down. So that's why we, and particularly me today, have been very frustrated, because we get sucked into this narrative of, come and be our partners, we'll co-produce, we'll work with you, that's great, that's fantastic, you get it, but there's 100 people over there that don't get it. So how does, and it's as simple as training and talking and communicating. So what's being done to make that happen?
And that's a fantastic point, so thank you. And that's probably one of the, sorry, I will answer directly, but there's a question that feeds into a comment that Andrew had made earlier, which is that at the moment, where we are with the strategies and the sausage machine of the getting through and push through, and as much as that's really frustrating because it delays the strategy actually being published, the important part of that is because it is an all-age strategy, the reason why it's taking so long is that if we want it to be active with people on the ground who are doing the work rather than just me who sat in the office, it's making sure that that's been signed off and cited and approved with the right level of push from all of those different parts of the council. So I suppose if it would have been an adult strategy, the people who would have the permission to push people and train them and make it mandatory would sit within the adults directorate. But because it's an all-age strategy, it's adults, it's children, it's education, it's health partners, it's all of those other people who, although it's not their strategy, they don't own it, they need to sign that off and they need to agree that process, that actually if we have it here and it's in the work plan and we say it needs to be improved, even though I'm not an employee of Oxford Health or if I'm not an employee of Bob ICB, that there's sufficient buy-in that we can say, you've got to do it.
What's the incentive for them then? Well, the incentive is... There's cost savings attached to this that they're going to generate. Because obviously, if you had a conversation this morning, if it's going to cost any more money, or if it's going to cost any money, it's not going to happen, is it?
So the incentive is kind of system improvement and reduction of waste through that. We're not saying that it's going to take money away from any of the services. The likelihood is that actually people are more aware of them, more people are going to use them. But then it's also that conversation around not wasting resource, and apologies for using that term, wasting resource, but in unnecessary processes as well. So if everyone understands...
So is it AI-enabled?
It's not AI, but I wish we had.
It's revolution, because, like, frankly, that's what we need.
It's not revolution in terms of that kind of thing. You know, I don't have a clever Microsoft process working in the background to generate these reports for me, but it is revolution in terms of that the system approach to not being diagnostic processes and it's needs related, and actually it's looking at some of these things where we're saying you're wasting unnecessary time and resource on something. If everyone knows, rather than, you know, that this person is autistic or they're ND, then why put all of the time and money and the resources and effort into getting that piece of paper when we can maybe use an alternative approach where by consensus we could agree on this and then agree what actually... Don't focus on that, focus on what the intervention needs to be in order to stop it.
So early intervention
There will be pilots that each of the areas who sit within the work plan are developing, but then the key thing for us, I suppose, is being able to reflect that back and communicate it so that we can get the valuable feedback on that. Yeah. Well, bit's not working, or this bit is working, we do more of it.
So how is this being measured? What's it being measured against, and how's that being fed back?
I'm not answering that question, but I'm just coming back to what you said earlier in terms of GPs and GP appointment, where you wasted an appointment. It's those kinds of gains that means the system becomes more efficient.
I'll fly through the next one because the second slide is more adult focused. But then, just very briefly, the other areas that kind of sit within our area are short breaks for children's services. Again, we're well aware of the limitations of short breaks for children's services. We'll come to you, sir. But at the moment, we currently have a very small amount of commissioned services for overnight respite, which comprises the Vines, Merrifield and Grove, and also includes the Bucks Activity Project for kind of day opportunity style short breaks. We've been speaking regularly with Andrew and Phil about what we need to do with that service, and there is a transformation programme happening within Children's they want to look at it rather than that service in isolation, all of the bits that surround that piece of work as well. So, you know, whether that's a happy project, whether it's voluntary and community options that are out there, whether that's kind of how direct payments feeds into this or other alternatives, it's looking at the whole thing rather than us simply looking at just the commissioned piece of work. Because if we look at just the commissioned piece of work, then we're going to end up with the same kind of thing, aren't we, really? So at the moment, we're looking at how we're putting the contracts in place for the extension of these services that facilitates the wider review of that piece of work. Market sufficiency, you've heard about from everyone else, so I won't go over this in vast, vast detail, but it's around developing services which are more specialist within Buckinghamshire so that we aren't so reliant on out-of-county placement, that we aren't so reliant on out-of-county residential services, that we've got more special support for complex physical disability, for complex autism services, for services around mental health where there are kind of severe self-injurious behaviour, suicidal ideation, eating disorders of eating, that kind of thing too. So myself and Adrian are working with a number of providers to discuss how we can develop those services within Bucks rather than always having to be relying on external.
And that is, I know it's not related, but I'm just verifying because I'm one of the people here with 20s, that will cover that age bracket as well?
We're absolutely not just talking about children, we're not just talking about adults. It's need rather than age based.
Can you just make sure that the social workers again know how direct payments work? They can't comprehend that you pay in advance, not in arrears, even though it says it on your paperwork, what we have to sign, and they can't work out count. They can't count.
Feedback will take it back to the
And I can't stress again enough, I know there are people in this room that whose children have been subject to restraint and other, you know, and let's face it, Bucks hasn't got its hands clean in terms of their residential settings either. You know, what we need to feel that our young people are safe. And at the minute, you know, I know you've spoken about flags on records and passports, and that's great. I'll be really honest, I don't want my son having a flag or a passport at the minute because I don't feel that puts him in a safe position, quite honestly. So there we go. You know, I need to know that, you know, that everyone has been on the McGowan trained and that everyone has, because frankly, at the minute, I don't feel that he's safe and I don't feel that, you know, there is an overriding, those kind of, what are they called? The
known
principles, thank you. Yeah, I don't feel that these known principles are adhered to, and frankly, routinely disregarded. Yeah.
What would be a really good provision? When my son had quite a severe mental health breakdown, I got sent home and got told, lock yourself in the house for 2 weeks, call the police. We have the police out every day, 3 times, 4 times a day. He needed to be in a mental health unit, but he wouldn't have coped being away from me. There needs to be a specific provision where actually parents can go in there with them and make it so it's a safe environment for everybody. Because otherwise,
I'll let my colleague Adrian talk a little bit more about those gaps, because one of the things that we are talking around as well here is what we refer to as a progression model. And that's the heart of the commission speak for it, but essentially what that means is looking at support that can help to not escalate to a point of inpatient care. So you're not needing to go into that ward. How we can essentially float people in to provide intensive support for a period of time. Which will,
if they've got psychosis, that's not going to help, is it? Because they don't know what planet they're on. That's what my son was like. He had psychosis caused by anxiety, but he still would not have been able to be locked up in a mental health unit, then end up being restrained. He needed me as his support network with him, and that's a service what needs to be put out there. Because it's can't be all or nothing. And we weren't safe in the house, and the police picked up pieces.
But then you're not safe in the priory either.
No.
I mean, I'm really sorry that that was the experience that you had. And as my colleague said, I'm more than happy to speak with you individually around those circumstances afterwards. But you know, we are working on meeting those gaps in provision which we know are there. We know that those gaps exist. So it is about trying to meet those requirements with things that don't currently exist. So that's what we're looking at in terms of how many people require them, who we can bring in that has the right level of expertise, and then how we can make sure that they operate them as close to Bucks or in Bucks as possible. I will just quickly talk about this bit as well, CTR and DSR management, and that ties in also to kind of prevention of admission to inpatient services. So I suppose on both ends of it, how can we help people out of inpatient settings as effectively as possible? Because obviously those settings are not conducive to helping people out with a lower level of support requirement. But equally, it would be good if we can prevent that in the first place. So the management of the DSR is a dynamic support register of individuals who are known that have a combination of learning disability, autism, neurodiversity, and are experiencing bouts of mental health as well, and how we can be more proactive in putting in those correct interventions to prevent that escalation happening. So our team do kind of chairing and facilitation of those meetings, bringing the team together so that we can hopefully reduce the number of young people or adults in Bucks who have to go through that experience. And then the last bit is, this truly is kind of a large part of the day-to-day stuff, but we've got a large number of residential support services within the county and within, just outside of the county as well. And we need to make sure that those are safe and those are providing good quality services. And our teams go out, they do contact monitoring, they visit the services, they work with CQC, with the Home Office, social work partners, and there is an assessment of the quality. We will make recommendations to those providers about how they can do things differently or better. Equally, giving them plaudits where they're doing well, but it's about improvement of the service, making sure that they're linked into training as well. If we're talking about statutory provision, that if we're putting someone in the care, in the support environment, that we know that the staff there are adequately trained and that there are professionals who are caring and respectful and treat these individuals with dignity. So our job was also around the, once we put it in place, making sure that it is of the correct quality. I'm really sorry for running over, and sir, I'll come to you for your question if that's all right.
Yeah, it was about acts for children. I had a friend who went to a meeting about a year or so ago. She met with someone, Ben, I'm not sure of his second name. He was in charge of things like acts for children at some point, I don't know where from. She was told they were going to do up and review soon. Is that correct? Has it been done? Have we not been told?
No,
because there are several issues with that service. I'm not withholding the expense now. For example, my children are accessing Tomley, which is a day centre for children with needs. On their site, you can go all day for £13, or if you're trying to get it, it's £11. My children to go then with it, it's £40 each time, which is an absolutely ridiculous cost. Yeah. Exactly. How can they justify that? And this, I've had my children start little breakfasts with Nando's, then playing day and then lots for the children. They changed the criteria over a few years ago where you could either have weekend provision or holiday provision, now you have to have both. Not every family needs that. My children have respite at another place in the every week.
You'd be making a care contribution to that,
you
don't just get given that.
You're actually
paying.
Yeah, no, we have to pay.
You have
to pay. Yeah. I get 50% off because of all of us are credit.
Yeah.
But still, if I wanted to go all day, yeah, exactly. But things like swimming, £15 per time, I can get at half price. And there's never been a real reason they've upped these prices. devices. It's just old cost, this, that, and the other. The way they sometimes deal with the children is inappropriate. Also, things I argued to the other a little while ago in the summer, there was an incident when a pizza in the cinema even during the evening, and there was an incident there between my son and another child. What sparked off is they gave the children a choice of film. Where in the hell is that? It's a good idea. Also, when you're dealing with, and my point is, they deal with children from 8 up until 16 or 18. There should be a separate. There should be two educators, and it just doesn't look like that. So when you're giving children the choice of two films, no way they're going to agree. There was an incident that occurred with my son and my child. I was not phoned, told about it, or anything. The other child phoned his parents or his dad as well, but phoned with him, and they went and picked him up. I then have to, at the door, fill in a form that wasn't completed. I have to sign it. Now, in the past, when this has happened, you get a phone call and it happens. It'll be, can you come, or how is he going to come down half an hour later? I'll go again. Well, I have two children to pick up. That has really gone really bad lately. About 2 years ago, after COVID, they started excluding my son from activities because they couldn't cope with it. You are a respite service. And that's just ridiculous. You know, my children go there because we've had social services, etc. And now, like I said, the cost of the things we do have absolutely skyrocketed.
I think you've given Ollie some key, yeah. some lived examples that need to be taken back in terms of the current service. The question you asked, is it being reviewed? The answer is no. Because it was due to be reviewed by the commissioning team. The commissioning team invented by it because the Director of Children's Services decided to have a Children's Services wide transformation review. And we have raised our eyebrows and other things about that, and yet there's nothing. Certainly this team can do about it, or we can do about it, because that's the way it's been. So yes, the short break service needs to be overhauled. Your individual points about the current running service, I'm sure Ollie will deal with, happily take those away or deal with others. But a general question about review of it, yes, it's a well overdue.
So it was supposed to be reviewed and just didn't get done?
You know, it hasn't been done because it was stopped.
That's what I said, it was supposed to be reviewed. It was done, which was, I don't know, many years
7 years?
Parents went along to some of it.
Yes, and that would be coming now, and it would have happened, and we were all set to do it, and then it got stopped hierarchically. So, are we going from all the year? Oh, is it now?
Thank you, everyone, for your patience.
And you're going to do all age mental health, are you, in 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
Minus 2 minutes.
Afternoon, everybody. My name's Adrian Tyne, and I'm the lead for the all age mental health team. There's teams about seven staff, and it's split into two sides. So one side it focuses on the adult mental health block contract. So that's the contract is sits with the ICB, and my team has delegated responsibility to contract and performance manage that area. And you can see there's quite a range of services within that area. So it's quite extensive. So we manage contract management and performance those areas. Our other areas that we work in within the adult side of things is dementia services. So we're in the process, one of our priorities at the moment is recommissioning the dementia support service, and the contract is due to commence and end in April, so there's a lot of work in that. And also, as Ollie mentioned, around the inpatient discharge into the community, looking at sort of the step down and ensuring that there's the provision back into the community, or is the family home be safe and managed appropriately. So that's sort of the adult side of things.
I have a real concern. So my son would be 17, he gets a lot of support and is on a psychiatrist. I've been told by CAMHS, because he gets loads of support by CAMHS, as soon as he hits that 17, he will be discharged and he will not meet the criteria for any mental health team. Yeah.
You can request that they don't share it. There's a huge transitions process that's meant to take place between CAMHS and adult mental health within Oxford Health areas. There's a leaflet that they never share with anyone that I can give you a call.
Okay. Because I'm really concerned about seeing in the heart.
So you're quite right.
It goes to yet another intrusive panel. My son was in the same position, going to be discharged back to GP because he's a psychiatrist.
took for us to get psychosis to get good.
So you're quite right, the eligibility and the criteria for need is different from children and adults, and that's across the national, so it's not specific to Buckinghamshire, but you're quite right, that is a big challenge. Once you hit adults, the sort of levels of support can diminish.
And can I just ask something on that? Because, and I forget where in law I read this, but basically where you've got a child who has an EHCP, so obviously that's taken them from fear into services until they hit the age of 26. It's all the night before their 26th birthday. It very clearly talks around, you know, only transferring a young person to adult services when that is appropriate to do so. Actually, it shouldn't have anything to do with their age, and yet Buckinghamshire, literally, on the stroke of midnight, you're out at 18. When, you know, so for my son, just as an example, you know, he was 18, turning 18, still in a fully residential specialist school, still had all the mental health care provision and everything around him at school, so actually still accessing some kind of services, but they just transferred him. It was like, well, he's not behaving like an adult in any other way, he's not being treated like an adult in any other way, but you're transferring him. And then of course, you know, with adult services, the minute you're not immediately accessing something from them, there's no keeping you on the books, or you're out.
That's a perfect example. So myself and Ollie have been in situations where a young person's in an adolescent unit, and literally the kid's 18 and they go, right, they need to go out. So we have to work quite extensively with the hospital provider, the support to try and enable that sort of transition, because just because they turned 18 doesn't mean that they're, you know, able to manage within an adult subset.
Houses in like foster homes, because I've got a friend of mine who works in like a house, and they have carers come in, and they basically say it's an awful shame we get them on track, we get them where they need. It goes literally on their 18th birthday, they're back on the street and they're homeless again. And she said, you see it all the time.
I think it's the regulations, isn't it? Something different up to it.
Yeah, but in between the transition, they are literally homeless and back to square one.
So a lot of our work is trying to facilitate and sort of plug that gap between sort of going, hold on, you can't just shut it down.
Yeah.
You need to sort of collaborate with your transfer to your sort of the adult services and make sure that it's
possible. Like I say,
it's a challenge.
Yeah, but in some instances, like, I don't think legally actually they have to transfer them. And this is why it's like, well, why are we doing that then?
So they still have the duty of care.
Yeah.
Maintained, the duty of care still remains. Yeah. So it's a real challenge for us as a team to try and say, hold on, you can't just.
I think the challenge is that the STEM, of course, it goes to 25, but within ethnic health, and health never changed.
Right.
It, so it will stop at 18 for health.
Well, to 16 actually. For some of the other stuff,
for some of the other stuff, the community services is generally required, so it's to 18. But actually, yes, in the world of trends, it's still 21 and 6. And that's, I think, is one of our challenges, is that we're applying things that are given to us from above. It's a bit like, you know, NHS England saying, well, okay, you can be on the DSR if you've got a learning disability or autism diagnosis, but actually knowing that most places you've got a diagnosis. So I think that's a challenge that we sit in on a day-to-day basis, and I don't know the answer to it, because actually that's what we're being directed, you know, the NHS England or whoever, the government, you know, whatever body it is, are saying to us, well, actually, yeah, they can do it, you can be regulated up to this point, and then after that it needs to shift to somebody else, without changes in what's coming down and we're being told, it's very hard to do that. And you can do bits locally, like I know I think it's a real challenge.
And there's a young person at the end of that challenge. And that's the thing. trying to desperately.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from our point of view, we know that, and we want to do what we can to support, but you've also got your hands tied a little bit by what we're being told is our rule of the school.
But again, the planning part of that is important, yeah. Because, you know, the crisis comes when,
The transition, if you want to do the transition thing, has been well aired through them, because you've got the health rush for us on the transition. So it is, it went to health care and being more, and everybody said we've got a problem, we're going to wait to see.
It's been worked on hugely.
Lots of people have got good intention to it, but it's none of those people down. Can you go to your last slide?
Yeah, just on Carolyn's point, we're looking at reasonable adjustment teams, adjustment service, so those young people who are. Patients who are in the inpatient setting have got neurodivergent needs. We're looking trying to expand that offer across the top of the area. So maybe a part of that sort of conversation could be looking at the sort of transitional side of things and trying to make sure the environments that they move into are being
addressed. When you say
regional
service, is that Barrow, the ones that sit in the
Whitegate?
Because they're just so poorly funded.
There's only two of them.
Barrow have absolutely no involvement at all with the neurodivergent person or their family. They gave advice to the professionals within mental health and social care about my children, my young adults, without having met them. And it was generic, it could have been done within 30 seconds on Google, and it was actually detrimental to them as well. It wasn't person-centred, it wasn't about them.
Yeah,
so they need a lot of work.
So the idea is to try and match what Oxford Officer have. Yeah. So they've got 9 posts, and we've got one currently, because there's 2 posts, but only 1 person.
Yeah.
And the good thing is, the ICB recognised that there's a gap in Buckinghamshire. So Adrian and I are trying to build the case for change, aren't we, with Ollie, around actually how can we build this type of service in Bucks? How can we actually support more people, actually give that right type of advice, you know, the things that you were talking about in terms of restraint? How do we make the change? And I think this team will be really important to do that. So, yeah, fingers crossed that we get the funding
So the other side of my team, they predominantly look at the children's mental health side of things. So, the CAMHS contract sits again with the ICB, but we've been given delegated responsibility to contract and performance manage that service, those services. So again, here's sort of a list of all the various services that falls within that CAMHS portfolio. I think that sort of we meet regularly with the head of service of CAMHS, and in terms of the CAMHS service and also the neurodivergent pathway as well. So Oxford Health are their areas, the assessment and diagnostic aspect of the neuro piece. So we try and we meet them regularly to try and drive the waiting times down and ensure that we get staffing across the board. The main sort of areas of work that we're going through at the moment is the mental health support teams. So we currently got about 90 schools covered under the mental health support teams. We're hoping to reach about 106 by January, so that's about 65% of the schools within Buckinghamshire Council. So mental health support teams, if you don't know, they in-reach support into schools, supporting young people with low to moderate mental health, so try and manage that before they go down, sort of CAMHS route. And then, the neuro, big area.
I think certainly if we talk from my daughter's perspective on this, and I don't know whether her school counsellor has come in by that project or whatever, but, you know, a lot of that is around forcing them into school still. You know, it's managing that, you know, the anxieties that arise from being undiagnosed and your needs being unmet within the mainstream school environment. And yet, you know, the message then is, well, we'll give you support in the form of a counsellor, but actually that person's just there to try and reinforce the message of you must be in school and you must be doing all this stuff, but actually doesn't really generally have much of an understanding of neuro being neurodivergent, and certainly not in a respectful neuroaffirmative way, and actually when you're not diagnosed anyway.
serve as a school, like, so
yeah, yeah, we know it's meant
but
to be
some schools are better than others, and but I think, yeah.
So there's a whole thing about, like, how does that mental health support in school interact with the overriding attendance targets and the attendance officer and inaction by the centre? Because as we heard earlier, actually it is inaction, because actually we're not getting any needs met by high needs block funding, and while you're sat on a waiting list for EHEC needs assessment that's then not even being carried out in the time frames that they set up, and on the waiting list for an EP and then when you get to the end of that, even if your needs have been assessed and completed, there's no staff to deliver it, and you have to take the local authority to court to actually get the provision. So we're looking at like maybe 2 years. Forget actually getting a piece of paper that diagnoses you, but those needs are unmet for a hell of a long time.
Which just causes more.
It just